this renovated courtroom, a day that should be in celebration, and a week in celebration. And as you know, the court is, in, along with the rest of the country, deeply concerned about our citizens in D.C. and New York City. We have today with us, as part of the Court with Class program, which is a nationally acclaimed program, which has won awards across the country, 30 homeschooled children representing 8 families, and they're attending with attorney Dan LaFave, who is arguing one of the cases. Would our students please stand? Well, thank you very much. We're delighted you're here, and we hope that you find this an interesting and educational experience. You may be seated. We've been delighted to meet you, and I'd like now to introduce the court to all of you. On my far right is Justice David Prosser. Seated next to him is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To my immediate right is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice John Wilcox. And to his left, Justice Patrick Brooks. And on the far left, Justice Diane Sykes. As you know, the President has asked that time be set aside today to mourn the dead, to grieve with their families, enter our hopes for the well-being and survival of many, and quick recovery of the injured. Express our anger at this carnage and be resolute in seeing that violence across the world be ended. And the court will join in that. I'm therefore going to try and move these proceedings so that we are completed by 11:45, so that you all may join with other Madisonians or return to your homes and express your mourning. So we will proceed that way, and yet I do not intend that any of your clients be hindered by this schedule, and I would ask all of us for a moment of silence. The fact that all of us have had difficulty concentrating and focusing on our everyday lives and everyday cases. And as the attorneys have said on both Wednesday and Thursday, that our being here is a recognition of the rule of law and law and order. So if we may proceed, the first case today is 01-0240W, State Ex Rel Thomas Haas versus the Wisconsin Court of Appeal. Mr. Jabot, representing Mr. Haas. Thank you.
I'm Patricia Jebo, and I have with me Mike Modell. We represent Thomas Haas, the petitioner, in the matter that's before the court today. The petition that is before the court is based on issues involving comity and mutual respect between the state and the federal courts. In preparation for today's hearing, and because I had not been in the refurbished chambers. I was here Wednesday morning and heard the comments of the court and focused on the mural behind the bench. I believed it to be the signing of the U.S. Constitution, which is very important for the issues that are specifically being addressed in today's argument. I went back to my office and used the internet, which my son taught me to use a while ago, and verified that it was in fact the signing of the Constitution, and learned that it was hanging there specifically as a symbol that the Wisconsin Supreme Court operates under the federal Constitution and is subject to its constraints. No surprise to any of us, but I did not realize that symbolism specifically. And it's symbolic of the dual court system which we operate under, which is the issue that is specifically before the court today. I start with the decision of the trial court in this matter, where it determined that the motion for summary judgment to allow claim preclusion based on a federal court judgment issued by Judge Crabb in Ramsden versus Agribank was not entitled to claim preclusion. The trial court said that the federal court did not provide an adequate opportunity for a full and fair adjudication of the underlying issue of this case. It's hard to imagine a finding that shows less respect for a federal court judgment than this finding, or less comedy between the state and the federal courts. We then sought and obtained an injunction from Judge Crabb, who determined that she needed to enter that injunction to protect the federal court judgment that she had previously issued. That was appealed to the Seventh Circuit, and the decision of the Seventh Circuit, which reversed that, is the reason we're here today and the reason for the petition that was filed. The Seventh Circuit reversed the injunction not because it found claim preclusion was inappropriate or that any of the requirements for claim preclusion hadn't been met, but reversed it on basis of concerns about comedy and created a brand new standard throughout the country, or at least for the Seventh Circuit. It's different than any of the other circuits that previously entertained, for granting judgments to protect, or injunctions to protect judgments. The court focused on heightened comity concerns and ruled that once a state considers a res judicata defense and rules that a prior federal judgment does not actually bar a claim, the affront of federal court intervention stripping the state court of power to continue is greatly magnified. After such a ruling, the interests in preventing possible relitigation are therefore generally outweighed by the heightened comity concerns, except in most extraordinary circumstances. Now, the goal, as stated by the Seventh Circuit in that decision, was to reduce friction between the state and federal court systems. That was the goal, and they said that. But the Seventh Circuit also recognized in a footnote, which is what I usually read first, that their decision would have the exact opposite effect. In that footnote, the Seventh Circuit recognized that this decision could cause litigants to immediately rush to the federal court for an injunction rather than going to the state court first and using the state court system in order to protect the preclusive effect of their federal court judgment. The Court of Appeals in this case did file a letter brief, and they also recognized that this decision, in Ramsden could create this friction between the state and federal court systems. Prior to that decision, there were different options available to litigants. And what happened in this case is what would normally happen, what was encouraged in the other federal court decisions, and that is you first seek preclusive effect from the state court trial judge. That was what was done. In light of this decision, litigants in the federal courts and the state courts, which is what I do, have to make a very difficult decision, or maybe it's an easy decision. If they are protecting a federal court judgment, they know that if they go to the state court, trial court first, they have basically eliminated any right to let the federal court protect its judgment. And therefore, if they want to give their client every protection that's possible, they have to believe they have to go to the federal court first so that they don't lose that right to get the federal court to protect the judgment.
If this were an Indian tribal court, how would this play out? That's right. We're going to go around the room. But
Your Honor, if it plays out the way that it did when Chief Oshkosh was tried, the state court would have recognized and have comedy for the federal court's judgment. And just as the territorial judge, Doty, ruled that Chief Oshkosh was not guilty of murder because he slighted someone who had slighted a relative of his, and that was within the law and the custom of the Menominees, I believe the same result would occur here, and that the state court would have recognized that under the federal court's rules and law, that it should recognize the federal law.
Does that mean then, if instead of having the federal court, the federal district court, and the Seventh Circuit involved, Stockbridge Muncie Tribal Court, which is a good tribal court, would enter an injunction against our state court? How does that all play out?
I'm not familiar with that particular.
Well, any of the numerous tribal courts that we have in this state.
I guess the first starting point is I don't know if they have the power to issue an injunction that would affect us. But assuming, for the purposes of your question, that the tribal court could issue an injunction, the tribal court must be concerned that the state courts are not going to honor their rules and customs, that they are not going to honor their law. When the two come into play against each other, there's going to have to be a supremacy. And I believe that in the federal courts, they look at both the federal law and they will look at tribal law and determine what is appropriate.
That's a digression, but it just made me think of the paintings that we have on this courtroom. That would be the next. I'm not going to go to Rome or England, so don't worry about that.
If we have to do one,
but you might go to the Teague decision.
That's right.
Well, counsel, you're stressing the relationship and properly so between the federal and state courts, but there's also an issue of the relationship between this court and the Court of Appeals.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that we have been reluctant to add mandatory jurisdiction to an already large bulk of mandatory jurisdiction for final judgments, right? And we've got a court that has 3,600 cases per year, that most of which they have to take, some of which they take on discretionary appeal. So the court's been very reluctant to do that. We have done it on occasion. But why should we do it here in light of that relationship, in light of the relationship generally of case management?
Your Honor, I think there are very strong policy reasons why this these type of cases should be heard by the court, and I believe they're even stronger than in the Arneson case, although some of the policies in the Arneson case also apply. Specifically, we start with the concern about comity between the two branches, or the two separate systems, the federal and the state systems. Comity, which the federal court in the Seventh Circuit has just recognized as a major concern. The second is the elimination of potential friction. When Judge Crabb issued an injunction stopping this case from going forward, that certainly had the potential for friction between the systems. And trying to not encourage that intervention, I think, is very valuable to the state courts. Policy concerns is that you want to be able to encourage litigants to use the state court system. And if you do that by granting the procedure we have asked for, litigants will feel very comfortable that they have a right to appeal if the state trial court does not recognize this preclusive judgment from the federal court. They won't feel compelled or at least very concerned that they need to ask the federal court to intervene in that situation. In addition, it gives the federal court a basis for turning down an injunction request. So if a litigant goes to the federal court first and says, I need a judgment to protect, or an injunction to protect my judgment, the federal court can say, no, you don't. You can take that to the trial court, and if you are not satisfied with the trial court, you do have an immediate right to have this matter heard by the Court of Appeals in the state. So take this issue to the state. In addition, it will allow the state courts to deal with the claim preclusion issues in the development of that area of law, rather than having these cases potentially being heard and decided in the federal courts. So those are very special issues related only to the kind of decisions that would be made in these res judicata cases involving federal judgments.
Ms. Chivo, if I could interrupt for a minute, do you have any idea, is there anything that you could set forth on the record that would tell us the numbers of cases that we might be requiring the Court of Appeals to take up?
Question that I asked as well, and when I was trying to prepare today's hearing and when it was previously scheduled. We contacted several different sources to try and see if there was a computer search that could be done to try and determine how many cases this might include. Unfortunately, everyone we spoke with said there isn't a database that we could get that from. But I did look at Arneson, and I looked at both the published and unpublished cases relating to the Arneson decision, which opened arguably a floodgate of cases. And I only found six, other than the Arneson case itself, that had either published or unpublished decisions since 1996. That does not appear to be a flood to me. So, and this is narrower. So it should be fewer cases than the Arneson decision.
Did you check with that clerk of the Supreme Court?
Someone in my office did.
Okay.
Counsel, did you get, I think you did, a copy of the March 12, 2001 letter of David Rice filed on behalf of the Court of Appeals?
Yes, I did, Your Honor.
And in that letter, the second page, he notes, and I think I'm editorializing, in a cautious tone, he says, the Court of Appeals disagrees with the petitioner that the cases in which the potential friction exists is a, quote, narrow class of cases, quote, and the, quote, number of cases involving assertion of the preclusive effect of a federal court judgment in a pending state court will be quite small. In other words, end of quote. Apparently, the Court of Appeals is taking issue with this narrow class of cases assertion that you're making. How do you respond to that if you're able to?
Well, first, I was pleased to see that the Court of Appeals indicated that even if that was, if they were correct in their assertion, that shouldn't be the basis for this court to make its decision. But then reaching more the merits of the concern that they've raised, I believe that if you look at the case law in United Mine and Parks versus City of Madison, which deals with pendent state claims in the constitutional cases brought to federal courts, the issue is fairly clear as to when the federal court has preclusive effect and when it doesn't. Those cases, I believe, clearly indicate that if the federal court makes a decision on the federal issues prior to a trial, the state court issues survive. And that if the federal court goes through trial, then the state court issues do not survive. And I believe the Court of Appeals could expeditiously deal with anyone who didn't understand those concepts or was trying to stretch them. And in fact, if there was no basis for the appeal, could sanction them. So I don't see that as a major floodgate issue. Of course, one never knows what will truly happen until a procedure is put in place, but I believe we're still talking about a narrow group of cases, particularly based on those dealings with dependent cases and constitutional issues.
Counsel, you may proceed.
Another reason for adopting, a policy reason for adopting the procedure that we are requesting is to prevent the waste of judicial resources. This case is a very good example in that thousands of pages were filed and reviewed as far as affidavits, documents, briefing in the federal court. The attorneys and litigants and courts spent a year reaching the decision. If this matter is allowed to be retried, the identical matter retried in the state trial courts, that effort will be duplicated by all those who are involved and will be a waste of judicial resources that have already been expended previously by all of the parties. I'd briefly like to touch on the policy issues comparable to Arneson. In Arneson, which was the qualified immunity case, as I know you're all aware, the court emphasized that qualified immunity is an immunity from suit. It's an immunity from having to go through litigation with the expenses, the hardships that go along with that. Res judicata is supposed to give you that same rest. The victor does not have to go through this again. And that is the same policy that was supportive of adopting this procedure in the qualified immunity cases. The entitlement is lost, just as in Arneson, if you have to go through the full trial procedure before you have the right to have the trial court's decision reviewed. The Ramsden
counsel, the ordinary rules, as I understand them, that you cannot seek review in this court of the Court of Appeals declining to take a case, declining to take a case an interlocutory matter. And you're here on supervisory writ, and you're here on this, quote, procedural issue rather than the substantive merits. Is there a way you can get here on the merits of the claim?
The only way I'm aware of, Your Honor, is after full trial. If we could have found another way, I expect we would have tried it. We couldn't. And if we have to go to full trial in this particular case, we have estimated more than $400,000 of additional costs, just in dollar amounts, as well as the time and the efforts to go forward. In the Ramsden's response to the petition we filed, they raised a number of issues relating to why the court should not grant this. One of them is that they argue that this case and this class of cases do not meet the requirements for an interlocutory appeal under 808.03 sub 2. I believe the contrary is very clearly true. The first alternative test that can be applied is whether or not the appeal would materially advance the termination of the litigation or clarify further proceedings in the litigation. Clearly, if the claim is barred by claim preclusion, it terminates the case. But even if it's not barred by claim preclusion, it will clarify what issues need to be litigated and And it could help shorten the case by encouraging settlement. Because as long as a defendant believes that the case is barred by claim preclusion, they are going to believe that that will protect them no matter what happens in the case, or at least give some weight to that and not be able to enter into serious settlement agreements or discussions. The second alternative test for the granting of an interlocutory is whether it would protect the petitioner from substantial or irreparable injury. Clearly, in this case, that would be the case, in that hundreds of thousands of dollars and hundreds of hours of time, not only by us and by Mr. Haas and by Agribank, but by the plaintiff and by the courts, will be spent unnecessarily if claim preclusion does prevent this case from going forward.
Counsel, those arguments that you're making, focusing on A and B and the waste of judicial resources and res judicata, claim preclusion relief as an arms, the argument you just made, seem to be applicable to all claim preclusion defenses, regardless of comity, regardless of federal court. In other words, if St. Croix County had granted a summary judgment and now we were back in Portage County, those same arguments that you're advancing now would be advanced. So is your argument, although it might be smart to keep it narrow, I mean, you know, little bit by little bit as the law inches along, but aren't the ramifications of your argument really to all claim preclusion defenses? All people who have a claim preclusion defense, you could argue as a bright line rule, there should be an interlocutory appeal because it will, quoting sub A, materially advance the termination of the litigation, and also with regard to sub B. So is your argument really broader than federal court comity?
This portion of the argument is clearly broader, but I am using this only as a subset of the much broader argument relating to comity and the mutual respect by limiting this to federal court judgments. I am not asking for all claim preclusion issues in all state courts. If I were asking for that, I expect the floodgate issue that has been raised by the Court of Appeals and will likely be raised by the Ramsons would countervail any positives. But I'm talking about a much narrower case. The purpose of this part of the argument was simply to show some of the same things underlying Arneson also occur in this case.
Ms. Gibo, what would your reaction be if this court were to take the road that's been taken in some other cases? I think Jenich is one, where basically what we did was urge the Court of Appeals to take up matters like this rather than require them to do so.
It would certainly, Your Honor, be better than nothing.
But that's the half a loaf that you're talking about.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe there are reasons why the court moved from the Jenich decision, where Judge Abramson suggested this particular procedure that I'm asking for today and actually adopted it in Arneson, rather than using the Jenich formula of asking the Court of Appeals to look carefully at it. And again, because this is an issue between these two co-equal systems, I really think the decision that this is so important should come as a rule from the Supreme Court, not just a suggestion. The third basis for granting an interlocutory appeal is that it clarifies an issue of general importance in the administration of justice. And in this case in particular, and in the class of cases, I think this is the one that perhaps is most important. In this case, the trial court has indicated that the Ramsons did not get a fair adjudication. They did not get a fair trial in the federal court. because of the use of the federal rules of evidence. Clarifying whether or not that is a basis for denying claim preclusion effect is a major issue to all litigants in the federal courts and the state courts, because Daubert and the federal rules of evidence are used in every diversity case. And so as to Haas itself, that is a major issue. As to the class of cases, any time that a federal judgment is determined not to be preclusive because of a use of a federal rule or such as a federal rule of evidence, that is going to be a very important issue for the administration of justice in Wisconsin. And for that purpose alone, I think that alone is enough policy for these cases to be heard and decided. Success on the merits was raised.
I'm sorry, counsel, your time is up. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Cita. Ms. Cita representing the Ramsdens.
Good morning. My name is Bob Cachetta, and I represent the Ramsdens, as Your Honor said. May it please the court, what I would like to do is to structure my comments in two ways. First of all, give you basically a précis without re-arguing our brief of what I think this case really comes down to, and then address, if I may please, point by point, the policy issues that counsel raised not only in her oral argument, but also in the brief, and to establish that those policy reasons do not argue in this case for an extension of the Arneson Doctrine. Now, I would respectfully submit that if this court took a look at this case from the perspective of how it would be positioned if some other litigants had already obtained the extension of the doctrine, the issues in the case become clear. We know, first of all, that what Haas is asking is an immediate appeal. Haas is not being denied any justice. Haas's justice, to the extent that it is affected, is delayed, as Section 808.03 sub 2 delays every non-final order appeal, and does for very good policy reasons. So we start with the premise that Mr. Haas, the petitioner before the court, is not being denied justice. We start also with the premise that, as the court, I believe, prudently noted in the Arneson decision in 1996, the ability of the Court of Appeals to determine what interlocutory appeals it will take must be jealously guarded. And as this honorable court knows, it has been invited on numerous occasions to mandate that certain sorts of appeals would be taken and must be taken by the Court of Appeals, and that this court has consistently resisted those attempts by litigants to obtain immediate access to the Court of Appeals. Now, to the question of where this case would be if the extension had already been granted, I respectfully submit to you that nothing would have changed in the history, with the exception that the Court of Appeals would have been forced to take the interlocutory appeal. The notion that this case turns on comity is a fallacy, because if the doctrine of Ramsden versus Agribank, in which the Seventh Circuit held that once a state court decision is made regarding collateral estoppel, there is no further federal action permitted except in extreme circumstances. If we take that as a given, which it now is according to the Seventh Circuit, then the litigants had no choice but to immediately proceed to federal court, regardless of the presence of an immediate interlocutory appeal, regardless of the presence of a mandate which said that the Court of Appeals would have to take a collateral estoppel argument immediately, or claim or issue preclusion argument immediately. Because if the litigants didn't proceed immediately to federal court, if the petitioner had not gone immediately to seek an injunction, then they would have waived their right to any access to federal court. Because under Ramsden versus Agribank, the Court of Appeals in the Seventh Circuit said, if
you don't go to federal court first, you have no federal rights. And so to the extent that the petitioner's position can be taken at face value, and that this argument for an extension of the Arneson Doctrine comes down to whether or not comity will be served, then it doesn't make a difference. It doesn't make any difference at all.
So you're suggesting that everybody in this situation is going to go to federal court first anyway, regardless of what we say about the interlocutory appeal issue?
Yes.
And that's the practical effect of Ramsden as litigation strategy?
That's correct. When Ramsden versus Agribank said, you have to start with federal court or you can't come to federal court, the presence or absence of an interlocutory appeal ceased making a difference. Unless one presumes that there is automatically, and always, because that's the suggestion of Arneson in 1996, that there must always be a condition mandating that the Court of Appeals take the case, unless one presumes that there is always greater wisdom at the Court of Appeals than the district court, there's no difference. And what is being sought here is, for this litigant, an opportunity to immediate access to the Court of Appeals. No matter make a policy difference at all in the state of Wisconsin. And it will certainly not serve comity in the way that's been suggested, or I respectfully submit, in any way. Because the issues, the tension arises when there was a federal case and there was a state case. And whether it's the federal court making comments about the quality of justice rendered in the state court, or whether it's a state court making comments about the quality of justice rendered in the federal court, that tension exists. Now, if I may, I'd like to move on to the policy considerations that are the basis for Mr. Haas's position. The first one is this notion of comity. And counsel has focused on language of Judge Fugar from Portage County Circuit Court, in which he indicates in one isolated sentence that he does not agree with the Daubert decision, and that he is concerned that a fair trial was not, or a fair result was not obtained in federal court. Quite frankly, this honorable court has had an opportunity to decide on Daubert when State versus Peters concluded that Daubert shouldn't apply in Wisconsin either. And that when Daubert applies, for very good and I submit valid reasons, Daubert sometimes does not yield a fair result. And I believe in this case, Judge Fugar was completely appropriate in noting that because of the imposition of the Daubert decision, the Ramsdens were never afforded their day in court. And that, under the rules of Wisconsin and the common law of the state of Wisconsin, in contrast to the common law at the federal court level, equity is the overriding concern when it comes to collateral estoppel. And what he was doing, clearly, in his decision, was basing his conclusions upon considerations of equity. Now, if counsel quarrels with the language and counsel perceives it to be a slight coming from the state court to the federal court, this is the nature of the actions where collateral estoppel is an issue in federal and state claims. Second point counsel raised as a public policy reason for further extension of the Arneson decision was the elimination of friction. That's the same issue. And it's the same result. The third one was to encourage litigants to use the state court system. We go back to the notion of what motivation will there be if this honorable court extends the Arneson Doctrine and mandates that the Court of Appeals must, in every case where there is a federal and state claim and a defense of collateral estoppel, take that appeal. What then is the incentive for the litigant to remain in state court? There isn't. Because the litigant can come back to state court after having asserted whatever federal injunctive rights he or she might have, and still assert whatever appellate rights exist, and whatever trial court rights exist at the state court, just as Mr. Haas did in this case. And I would note, not necessarily parenthetically, that the same arguments which are now being made regarding collateral estoppel were rejected by the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, at least inferentially, were rejected by the United States Supreme Court when they petitioned for cert on the same issues, were rejected by the trial court by Judge Flugar in this case below, and inferentially were rejected because they couldn't satisfy the requirements of 80803 to get an interlocutory appeal heard.
Counsel, you have continuously referred to collateral estoppel in your arguments. Issue preclusion. Your counsel oftentimes referred to res judicata claim preclusion. Is there any difference in the analysis, whether it's issue or claim preclusion? If we talk, can we lump them together, or I just note the difference in your discourse.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you, and I didn't mean to be sloppy in my language. There is a difference for purposes of the arguments on the merits below, and that difference is that with regard to issue preclusion, there is a case which very strongly says that if the same bundle of legal principles, which is the operative language, does not apply, then issue preclusion cannot apply. So when we look at claim preclusion and issue preclusion, for purposes I respectfully submit of this proceeding, they are the same, but not for purposes of the merits here below. Now, the additional argument was made by counsel that the extension of the doctrine, the Arneson doctrine in this case, will give the federal court a basis for turning down an injunction. Now, there is no measure by which the federal court is to determine that it should turn down an injunction simply because a party has quick appellate rights at the state court level. In the case law in federal court, there is not support for the suggestion that the district court, being petitioned for an injunction in a claim or issue preclusion case, should refrain from issuing that injunction because the parties have the right to ready access to the Court of Appeals as a matter of right at the state court level. That isn't part of the calculus that goes into a determination of whether an injunction should issue or not. Now, the next point that counsel made was that the state court can deal with claim and issue preclusion issues, and that this will somehow foster an encouragement of the state court dealing with those issues. This comes back to points one and two, and that there is no incentive here for the state court to be the court which is selected by the parties to first, or perhaps only, hear the issues. And if comity, and it is, according to the petition, if comity is the cornerstone of the petitioner's petition, then it fails on that consideration as well. Now, the other issue that counsel raised, and this was number six, was the waste of judicial resources. And this is very troubling because, as the court knows from the recitation of facts and the materials submitted, it was March of 1996 when the Ramstons purchased property which was polluted with gasoline, and they drank the water, and their cows drank the water for several months, and substantial damages were incurred. And the defender, the petitioner's position here is that judicial resources are a substantial concern, and when the judicial resources issue is addressed, we hear that there is a $400,000 bill that may be paid in the future, which is, for some reason, a basis for this honorable court to make a decision to mandate an appeal, which may or may not be successful. Well, I respectfully want to call the court's attention to the petitioner's own submission, which indicates that the petitioner here, which is not Haas and Agribank and a host of others, it's Mr. Haas. Mr. Haas is the petitioner, and by their own submission, the petitioner has indicated he bears no potential financial loss, that Agribank, his employer, a federal instrumentality, is paying his legal representation, in sharp contrast to the Ramstons, who have had to sustain substantial expense as a result of going through a number of levels of processes. So when this court, if this court, looks at the notion of judicial resources, I respectfully submit that it would also be important to consider whether, in fact, the party's judicial resources are what they are suggesting to be, and that Mr. Haas will not be out money if he has to litigate. His former employer may, but he will not. And in addition to that, whether there ought not be some consideration to the rights of these people to get to court after having had so much procedural attempt by the defense, strategically appropriate, but attempt by the defense to keep them from a jury. Now, finally, let me address an issue that was raised by the court and which I think is important, and it's this notion of floodgates of litigation. I agree with counsel. I don't think there's any way to quantify or even to responsibly qualify what kind of volume an extension of the Arneson Doctrine would create with regard specifically only to collateral, claim and issue preclusion in federal versus state type cases where comity is actually implicated. But perhaps the greater concern ought to be this, and that is that once this honorable court says that claim preclusion provides a basis for mandating the Court of Appeals to take interlocutory appeals, I predict that it will be a short time between that and the time that other litigants show up with equally compelling arguments about further opportunities to extend the Arneson Doctrine. And I respectfully submit that if, in fact, comity and concerns of comity are not the anchor for the extension of the Arneson Doctrine in this case, and I hopefully have covered for you why we believe that they cannot be, then there is no rational stopping point after which the Arneson Doctrine will not be extended. Because the next person to come in with strong issues of collateral estoppel or claim or issue preclusion and argue that they too have a special circumstance which is narrow in scope will be hard-pressed to understand why the court would not extend once again. Now, contrast that to where we are with Arneson today. Under 42 U.S.C. 1983, there is a very clear and mandated and federally prescribed defense of qualified immunity, which goes back to federal law and which is anchored in a very clear definition. It is also based upon an underlying public policy which does not exist when we talk about claim and issue preclusion. After all, the doctrine of qualified immunity is that public officials should not be subjected to suit where there is not a clearly defined legal right at issue. Now, the policy reasons for that are obvious in that we don't want to have our public officials subjected to suit without good reason. Now, the policy reasons I respectfully submit underlying collateral estoppel are different in that these are private litigants, in that the private litigants both will have absolute rights of appeal at the end of the case when there is a final judgment. And we come back to the fact that the only issue before this honorable court at this time is whether is going to have his appeal now, or whether he will have to await his appeal at the conclusion of the case. In contrast to the policy decisions which drive qualified immunity, which say we do not want to subject public officials to suit at all unless there is this substantial threshold that is satisfied. Unless there are additional questions, let me close and perhaps save some time on the morning schedule by thanking you for your attention. Counsel talked about the painting, and it is spectacular. But the painting reflects a system of government which has state and federal interests that have to interact. And in this circumstance, the state has already established a very good system which permits the state to mind its own house. And Article 7, Section 3 of the Wisconsin Constitution, which gives this court supervisory authority, appropriately has been employed by the court with great care, because the doctrine that underlies everything here is the notion that the Court of Appeals should have the authority to deny interlocutory appeals, absent some very compelling concern. I appreciate your kind attention and courtesy.
Thank you, Mr. Kishida. Ms. Chabot, you've got 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to start with what I think is the key issue, and that is whether or not, if the court adopts the procedure we've required or requested, will it make a difference? Attorney Cachetta suggests that it will not. I strenuously suggest it will. It will at the federal court, because one of the requirements in order to issue an injunction is that there is an inadequate remedy at law. And if the court, federal court, knows that not only is there the state trial court, but there is an immediate right of appeal if preclusion is denied, it is a very strong reason why a federal court won't grant an injunction. And if the federal court is not granting injunctions, people will not go there. It is a waste of time and effort and money. I also believe that people are comfortable going to the state court and to the state trial court, and will be comfortable knowing that if they believe a decision is an error, that they have an ability to have it rectified, and they have not given up a right of appeal, whether it be an appeal of the decision of refusing to grant an injunction and going up in the federal court system, because there is an automatic right of appeal there. Instead, they're going to get an automatic right of appeal in the state court, to the Court of Appeals, if preclusion is not granted by the trial court for a federal judgment. So I think this procedure really will make a significant difference in the practice of those of us who are in the federal and state court systems. Attorney Cachetta suggested that claim preclusion will not apply in this case, even if we have the right to an immediate appeal. Obviously, I disagree on the likelihood of the merits. Both the federal courts and the state courts have the same three requirements under their law. That is, the same parties and their privity, a final decision by a court of competent jurisdiction, and either the same transaction or the same issue being in front of them. Both the state trial court and the federal trial court, when it was looking at the injunction issue, found all three there. And I submit that unless an exception is being created under Wisconsin law to not honor a decision that turns on Daubert or on a federal rule of evidence, that the Court of Appeals will also agree that claim preclusion applies here. Addressing Daubert, this court has not adopted Daubert, but the actual rules are identical. Rule 702 is identical to Wisconsin's rule, and both rules require that someone be qualified. Judge Crabb, in her decision, specifically found that the expert in this case, Dr. Croft, was not qualified on two out of the three areas on which he was going to testify. One was that a veterinarian was not qualified.
That's why I'm going to interrupt you. Are we going to get to the merits of this court?
Your Honor, the only reason I was raising it was on likelihood of success. For the policy reasons that I've set forth in our petition, for the policy reasons I've described today, because I believe if this is adopted by the court, it will not only help my client, Mr. Haas, it will help litigants who have federal court judgments, and it will reduce the friction between the courts. It will show the mutual respect for both systems, which give fair trials and fair adjudications. And therefore, I respectfully request that the court adopt this procedure. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Before I close the hearing on this case, I want to advise both counsel, as well as everyone else in the courtroom, that in keeping with our Court with Class program, at when we complete this next case, there will be a discussion about the court's procedures with Justice Prosser, who is at that far end of the bench. All of you are welcome to come and welcome to listen and participate in that conversation, as well as our homeschool students. So I wanted you to all know that. Is either one of you a first-time arguer before this court? Well, I comment to both of you that on behalf of the court, that a good job was done by both.